So now I'm ready and happy to introduce Dan Aykroyd, who, as I tried to indicate earlier, unlike Martin and I who talk about this stuff, he actually does something. And he is spearheading the program to search for exotic dark matter, WIMP dark matter, deep underground, a difficult effort and an exciting one. And I'm certainly also very pleased and proud that he's a colleague of mine at Case Western Reserve.
Okay, thank you. So the title of my talk is Looking for WIMPs, Dark Matter Relics from the Big Bang. In the talks that you heard earlier today, both Lawrence and Martin touched on the idea that there are two main components of the universe that we don't know what they are. One of them is the dark matter, and one of them is the dark energy. And dark energy is just too hard a problem to approach experimentally. So I'm going to work on the dark matter problem. It's a problem that's been around for about 70 years. Fritz Zwicky first discovered that there was a lot of missing mass in clusters of galaxies. And the working hypothesis now is that that missing mass is made up of some sort of new fundamental particle that was produced in the early universe. So what I'm going to do is review a little bit of the astrophysical evidence for dark matter, in part because our Hawaiian colleagues didn't get to hear Lawrence this morning. I realized also the reason that I'm the featured speaker for Hawaii and not Lawrence is because they were all asleep when he was talking. So
are they.
So I'm not that flattered. Okay. What I also want to do is concentrate a little bit, even though I'm an experimentalist, I want to concentrate a little bit on the background evidence for dark matter, because if you're going to take 10 or 20 years of your life to go look for some crazy ghost particle that may or may not have been produced in the Big Bang, you want to make sure that it's a pretty good bet. Okay. You want to go through the evidence and make sure that there's something there. A microcosm of this is when I spent about a month measuring a peculiar property of graphite in the laboratory because we needed some low conductance graphite for one of the parts of our instrument. And 6 months later, one of my colleagues pointed out that these numbers were in a book. And my wife said to me, she said, "You know what they say? A month in the lab can save you an hour in the library." So it's an important lesson to learn. Okay, so you don't want to spend a decade in the lab to find out that you were chasing the wrong stuff. Okay. So like Lawrence and Martin, I'm going to tell you a story. Okay. And I don't know yet whether it belongs in the fact or fiction column of the bestseller list. Okay, we don't know the last chapter yet. It's a story that's 70 years old and we're still working on it. Maybe they'll have us back in 10 years and we'll be able to tell you the answer. Okay. So let me start again by showing you one of the poster children for dark matter that Lawrence touched on earlier. This is just these rotation curves. For our Hawaiian colleagues, what's shown in this graph is measurements of the speed. Is there a pointer? Thanks.
That's the point.
Okay. It's great when a theorist helps me with instrumentation. Okay. So what's plotted here is the rotation speed of stars in a galaxy as a function of their distance from the center. Okay. The basic idea is that by measuring the speed of the orbits of the stars, you can measure the strength of the gravitational field, which provides the centripetal force to keep them in their circular motions. Okay. If all of the mass in the galaxy were concentrated in a bulge in the center, then once you moved past the radius of that bulge, excuse me, you would expect the velocity of the stars to fall off with 1 over radius, 1 over distance from the center. But in fact, as Lawrence mentioned earlier, even as you go out to the very far reaches of the galaxies, well beyond where the bulk of the stars are, you still see these very high speeds, these very hot, fast circular orbits. And that indicates that there must be a lot of matter that's present that we don't see in the form of glowing stars. Okay. And so our working model for galaxies is that they may have visible disks of stars with bulges in the center, but most of the matter is in some large spherical halo of particles or some type of matter, and we don't know what that matter is, and it doesn't emit any light. Okay. By measuring the strength of the gravity, by measuring the speed of these stars, we can estimate how much missing mass there is, and it's something like, you know, 90% of the matter in a galaxy is this missing form of matter. Okay. Other ways to see it, I believe Lawrence showed this picture as well. It's one of our favorites because it's quite beautiful. This is can we have the lights down a little bit? I think it might project better. Thanks. You can see this is the basic cartoon here is that we're looking at starlight from a distant some background source, this cluster of galaxies here. And there's a background object that we're looking at that occurs along the line of sight to an Earth-based, well, the space-based telescope. And there's some material in between, the visible stuff in between that we see are these clusters of galaxies. And the light from the background galaxy is bent by the gravitational lens formed by these intervening galaxies. And if you add up all the matter in the visible mass that we see, it's not enough to create the amount of bending that we see. So it's another way of measuring the strength of the gravity. Okay, and the strength of the gravity is much stronger than what you expect from the luminous mass. So again, we infer that there must be some dark matter present in these systems. Okay, so the question is, what is the dark matter and how might we look for it? Well, the basic picture that we have of the early universe is that when it was very young, it was very dense, it was very hot, and collisions between the particles that make up the early universe were taking place at very high energies. And these are the same sorts of interactions that might take place in collisions between protons at Fermilab. Okay, the early universe was basically a particle factory. And any particles that exist in nature would naturally be produced in this factory. And Einstein told us how to figure that out. He told us that E equals mc squared. And so we can take light particles that are moving at very high speeds, collide them into each other, and have heavy particles come out. Heavy particles are just what we're looking for. Heavy particles could be the missing mass. Okay, so the basic idea, for example, is that a quark and an anti-quark come together, and out pops a WIMP and an anti-WIMP. A WIMP is just an acronym for a weakly interacting massive particle. Okay, it's the reason that it should be weakly interacting is because if it wasn't weakly interacting, then it should have condensed and formed stars like ordinary matter. Okay, and yet we don't see this missing mass emitting light. So one of the requirements for the dark matter that we're looking for is that it be weakly interacting. The other important property is that it have mass, because mass is what gives rise to gravity. Okay, so that's the other ingredient that we're looking for. And one of the interesting parts of the puzzle is that we know that protons and neutrons, ordinary matter, weren't produced in sufficient numbers to make up all this dark matter that's missing. Okay. So we believe that we're looking for a new type of particle, okay, which could have naturally been produced in the Big Bang. Okay. The question is this particle still around? Okay. If quarks and anti-quarks can come together and annihilate to form WIMPs and anti-WIMPs, you would think that WIMPs and anti-WIMPs could also come together and annihilate back into quarks or electrons and positrons and so forth. But what's interesting is that owing to their weak interactions and the fact that the universe is expanding, okay, you can reach a point in the early universe where the probability of a WIMP and an anti-WIMP running into each other to annihilate is so small that it'll effectively never happen. And these particles can be left over as relics or fossils from the early universe. Okay, so we're looking for a certain amount of this stuff. Okay, we have this idea that the universe is flat, omega is equal to 1, and that about 30% of that is made from the dark matter. Okay, so theorists can do calculations. In fact, I can even do this calculation to calculate what the interaction strength of a WIMP would be. What's the probability that a WIMP and an anti-WIMP would annihilate in the early universe, so that they would survive in sufficient numbers to be the dark matter. Okay. And what you come up with is a particular probability, a particular effective size for a WIMP and an anti-WIMP to run into each other. And the reason that that's important is because we need clues as to whether or not these particles will be detectable. Okay. So having some idea of their effective size, their probability of interacting, is one of the pieces of the puzzle to say, is it practical to try to actually detect these particles? Okay. And the answer is that maybe. Okay. So the idea then is that if WIMPs exist in nature and were produced in the Big Bang, then today they should be residing in the halo of our galaxy. Okay, so the model then is that the disk of the Milky Way is embedded in this big cloud of particles. They're in this room. There's about 100 per handful, and we're completely unaware of them. Okay. The challenge then is to build a sufficiently sensitive particle detector so that when a WIMP occasionally runs into a nucleus in this detector, you'll be able to record that. Okay. The problem is that these particles are so weakly interacting that even though there's so many of them, we expect there to be at most one interaction per day in a kilogram of detector material. Okay. So what I want to talk about now is just a slight digression about how we detect particles. Okay. I want to try to put some meat on the table. There's been a lot of stories about astronomers going off and doing things, and I want to give you some idea of how we actually conduct these experiments. How do we actually know anything in physics? Okay. In physics, we measure voltages. Okay. So the question is, how can we take some particle that you can't directly see and turn it into something that we can measure? Okay. A simple example is a Geiger counter. I would have brought mine with me, but I didn't really want to put it in my checked baggage, not these days. Especially with a Middle Eastern last name, I think that would not be a good idea. Okay. So I brought some videos. Okay, the next best thing. Okay. So how do we detect particles? Well, the basic idea of a Geiger counter is that it's good for detecting photons or charged particles. Okay, a charged particle will ionize the gas inside this probe. You'll use some voltage, you'll collect the charge on a capacitor or on a little speaker, and you'll hear a tick. Okay. There are other ways to do it. Particles in certain types of materials will produce flashes of light. Those flashes of light can be converted to photoelectrons. Those photoelectrons can be amplified and turned into a voltage. Or a particle can interact indirectly. It can interact with the nucleus. A charged nucleus will then deposit its energy in an active medium, and so forth and so on. So it's possible to turn individual particles into voltages that you can actually measure. And that's how we know when something went through our detector. Okay. So now, here's a video of... Oops. Oh no, you can't hear this. Can I get some sound help? I guess not. Yeah. What I wanted to do is a little demonstration for you. Okay. Can you hear it? Oh, there you go. You can hear it. Okay. So that ticking that you heard, okay, is just the background radioactivity in the room. Okay, there's a few grams of detector material in the probe of this Geiger counter. Okay, and you could count about one tick per second. Okay, one tick per second in a few grams of material corresponds to about 10 million counts per day in a kilogram of material. Okay, so we're trying to look for a single interaction per day in a kilogram amidst this sea of particles, amidst this sea of background radiation. Okay. And now we're stuck. Okay. Now it turns out it's even a little bit worse. Okay. Not only do we need to shield our detectors from this horrendously high background of particles, but there's radioactivity in the air. Okay, and so you'll see in the videos that I'll show you of our experiment, we do all of our work in clean rooms, similar to the types of rooms in which one makes computer chips. Okay, so I wanted to do here a practical demonstration. This is now we're going to do a before, during, and after of a piece of and then filter paper.
Run over that, the probability of finding the needle. If you just grab a handful of hay, the haystack.
Your method didn't do this.
What I'm doing here is taking background counts on a piece of filter paper. And again, it's comparable to the background radiation in the room. It's about one count per day on my Geiger counter. Okay. You guys have had this experience with demonstrations, right? They always seem to go better when you do them when you're alone. Okay. So now I've taken this piece of, well, my students have taken this piece of filter paper and stuck it on the end of a vacuum cleaner. Okay. And then we operated that vacuum cleaner for about a half an hour. Okay. Just drawing the air in the room, the dust in the room, through this piece of filter paper. Okay. We then took that piece of filter paper and put it back with our Geiger counter. Okay. So the dust in the air around us turns out to be radioactive. Okay. Those of you with basements, I guess if you don't live in Santa Barbara, maybe you have a basement. You obviously have heard of the radon problem, right? Radon is seeping out of the walls of your basement. There's radon in the air, a radioactive noble gas. Radon will decay. It will lead to charged daughter particles. Those particles will alight onto dust atoms. And then so the dust is radioactive. So what I've just done there is concentrate about a half hour worth of room dust onto this piece of filter paper, and you notice that it's more radioactive. Okay. So now, what has nature offered us? Nature is cruel. Okay. Come on, nature. Come on, computer. Microsoft. Computers are cruel. Okay. What has nature offered us? Nature has offered us this wonderful needle, but embedded it in this huge haystack. Right? We're looking for a single event per kilogram of detector per day. We're trying to find it in the sea of natural radioactivity. Okay, the Earth's crust is about a part per million uranium and thorium. Okay, and it's in everything. Okay, what you hope for is this. Okay, but as I said, nature is cruel. Okay, so how do we get rid of the haystack? Okay. What we're good at doing in our experiment, the reason that we have one of the best results in WIMP searches to date, is that we can try to get rid of the haystack. Okay, we take advantage of the fact that WIMPs look different. Okay, WIMPs look different from most of the radioactivity that we're trying to get rid of. Okay, most of the radioactivity comes from photons and electrons. Okay, and when these interact in a particle detector, they tend to collide with the electrons in the detector. WIMPs, on the other hand, because of their properties being different, tend to collide with the nuclei in a detector. And so if a photon or an electron deposits 10 keV of energy in a detector, that's going to look very different from a WIMP giving a nucleus in the detector a kick of 10 keV. The way that recoiling nucleus will lose energy will look different in our detector than the way an electron will recoil and lose energy. Now the way that we expose this difference is by measuring the energy that's deposited in the detector two different ways. Okay. The conventional way is to have the detector be sensitive to the amount of charge that's liberated. So for example, in the example of the Geiger counter, the amount of gas that's ionized per unit energy deposition in the detector will make sort of a conventional charge or ionization signal. Okay. The thing that's unusual about the detectors that we use in our experiment that I'm going to describe is that they're also sensitive to how much the detector heats up. Okay. Now this is kind of an amazing thing. We have these crystals, and I'll show you photographs, of germanium and silicon about the size of hockey pucks. Okay. Made out of material like this. Okay. Where did you get this?
I'll tell you later.
I won't. Okay. And what we do is we cool them down to very low temperatures, so that when a single particle interaction takes place in the detector, we can actually watch this macroscopic chunk of material warm up just a little bit. Okay. By measuring the amount of energy that appears as heat, we can exploit the way that WIMPs look different. Okay. It turns out that particles that collide with electrons will produce a little bit more, about three times as much charge energy, if you will. They're about three times as efficient as ionizing the detector as are nuclear recoils. Okay. So the basic idea is that if we measure a charge signal and a thermal signal simultaneously, we can make our background from photons and electrons look different from the nuclear recoils that we expect for WIMPs. Okay. And the way that we like to plot these variables is by taking the ratio of the two, so that these lines of two different of different slope are defined as, sorry, the ratio of these two quantities we define as a quantity called charge yield, and so that we can discriminate our background and signal in this way, and we can actually test this. We don't have a beam of WIMPs in our lab to spray at this detector to see how well it works, but it turns out that neutrons are a good test particle for WIMPs. Okay, the reason is that neutrons, since they're electrically neutral, they'll collide with the nuclei in a detector, so they make up a good test particle. So what we do to see if our detectors are working well is bring up a source of photons or electrons that we bombard on the detector, and when we do that, we get events that show a charge yield that's calibrated to be unity, calibrated to be one. We take away that source of photons or electrons, and we bring up a source of neutrons as WIMP test particles, then we populate a region of a plot at low charge yield. Okay. So when we actually run an experiment to try and detect WIMPs, if we see events that occur up here, we'll reject those as being some sort of background particle, like the kind of stuff that set off the Geiger counter. And if we see stuff that's down here, then those are going to be WIMP candidate events. So the way that these detectors work is, rather the way that they're made is using a photolithographic process. The basic idea is that we have these crystals of germanium and silicon, and if you zoom in, we've made these very tiny structures, these thin little meanders of superconducting tungsten film. And it's these little filaments of tungsten on the surface of the detector that are capable of sensing the heat. The basic idea is that when you cool the detectors down to very low temperature, the tungsten goes superconducting. Okay. And you might think of, so I've plotted here the resistance of the tungsten film on the surface of the detector versus temperature. Okay. So some of you may be familiar with the idea of the superconducting transition. Below some critical temperature, which for this phase of tungsten is about 80 millikelvin, below that transition temperature, the resistance of the tungsten will be essentially zero. Okay. And above that transition temperature, the tungsten will look like an ordinary metal. It'll have a few ohms of resistance for the geometry that we've set up. But there's a region in between that's about 10 millikelvin wide, and if you sit right in the middle of that transition, and a little bit of heat comes into your detector because a WIMP ran into a nucleus, okay, then that superconductor will warm up a little bit, and you'll measure a change in resistance. And if there's a change in resistance, then you can convert that into a voltage. Okay, this is how we measure voltages. Okay. So here's an actual event that we measured in our laboratory. On one side of the detector, you've got these superconducting tungsten filaments. And if you look at the resistance or the voltage across that filament as a function of time, an event will take place, and you'll see the voltage across that resistance change. And then as the detector cools back down, then that heat will flow out of the superconductor, and it'll go superconducting again. Okay. At the same time, on the other side of the detector, we put a voltage across it and hook it up to a charge amplifier. We basically collect the ionization that's produced in the detector on a capacitor, and we measure the voltage across that capacitor. And at the same time that we see a heat signal through the thermal sensors, we also see a voltage change on the charge sensors. Okay. What we do then is we take the ratio of charge to heat, and for each event that we collect with the simultaneous measurement, we put a dot on this plot. Okay. If the event that took place was from an electron recoil, then those events tend to congregate up here at charge yield of 1. And if those events take place due to a nuclear recoil event, they tend not to produce as much charge for the given amount of heat that's been deposited. And so then they tend to collect in the lower part of the graph. So this is our discrimination parameter. This is how we get rid of the haystack. Okay. In a few minutes, I'm going to show you some video of the experiment that we're building. But before that, I want to just show you a little bit about what you'll be looking at. The overall structure of the experiment and the strategy that we use is to, again, use this discrimination technique of measuring charge and heat. We put several detectors in these stacks, and we cool them down together. We take advantage of the fact that, well, I mentioned a few minutes ago that neutrons were a good test particle for WIMPs. Okay, that the fact that neutrons look like WIMPs should actually worry you. Okay, because when we actually do our experiment, if there are neutrons in the neighborhood, then those could try to fool us. Those could look like WIMPs. Okay. One of the ways in which neutrons are different from WIMPs, though, is that they interact much more readily. Okay? So if a neutron wanders into the detector apparatus, there's a reasonable chance that a neutron will scatter twice. Okay? A WIMP never would. An individual WIMP is so unlikely to interact that entering our apparatus, it would never interact twice. In fact, the first WIMP that runs into one of the germanium nuclei in our detector, that'll be the first thing that WIMP has interacted with, more or less since it was produced in the Big Bang. Okay. In that sense, these WIMPs that we're looking for are like these CMB photons. Okay. Their surface of last scattering was, 15 billion years ago. And then they just happened to wander into our detector and go smack. Okay. So the way that we operate these detectors is that we have to cool them down close to absolute zero so that these superconducting sensors can operate. We do so by placing them inside a very low radioactivity apparatus that's cooled by an external refrigerator called a dilution refrigerator. And then because, if you noticed in the, I think it was the previous plot, yeah, you can see that this ability to discriminate between the two different types of events isn't perfect, right? You could imagine that, just because of measurement noise, one of the events that, quote, should have ended up in the upper part of the plot might have dribbled down into the lower part of the plot, okay? Our discrimination works at about the level of 1 part in 1,000. For every 1,000 events up here, one of them might leak down into the lower part of this plot. So a photon could also fool us into thinking it was a WIMP. Okay. So to try to reduce the possibility of that happening, we surround the entire apparatus with various types of shielding material just to try to minimize how much external stuff can come in. So we have a multi-layered defense, if you will. Okay. So in 1999, we took a stack of four of these detectors, and we exposed them to nothing for a period of about 6 months. We just set them in the laboratory. If you build it, they will come. That's our philosophy. And after about 6 months, we accumulated a data set, which again was we plot as our ionization yield. This is our discrimination parameter as a function of energy. Okay, and what you see are these smears of events up here at high charge yield. Okay, so we can easily reject those as not being due to WIMPs. Okay, down here you see a light blue curve. Okay, this blue curve is where our neutron calibration told us we should expect to see nuclear recoil events. Okay, so it's between these dashed lines here that we would expect to see WIMP candidate events. Okay, and what we find after 6 months is that we see 13 events, these circled blue dots, that occur in this region of the plot. And so you could ask yourself, well, maybe those are WIMP candidates. Okay. In fact, we believe them to be either mostly or all neutrons. Okay. And the way that we can quantify that is by recognizing the fact, again, that WIMPs would only ever scatter once in the detector. Okay. Whereas neutrons, some fraction of the time, would scatter twice. Okay. So in this previous plot, we can say, well, my WIMP candidates are only going to ever be due to single scatters. So let me make this graph only for events that have single scatters. Okay. But at the same time, I can also ask how many double scatter events occur in the data. Okay. And what I find is that there are in the same data set that led to these 13 WIMP candidates, there were four events that looked like this, where there was a double nuclear recoil scatter. Okay, only neutrons would produce those types of events. Okay, and so what we do then is we run elaborate simulation programs to say that, for every double scatter due to a neutron that you see, how many single scatter events would you also expect to see? I mean, the idea is that the detectors are seeing some ambient flux of background neutrons. Okay. that same set of ambient neutrons will sometimes single scatter, will sometimes multiple scatter. By measuring the multiple scatters, we can predict to within some statistical error how many single scatters we see. Okay? And it turns out that those four multiple scatters are more than enough to account for the 13 single scatters that we see. So we have to take the conservative conclusion and say that we have to assume that these 13 events that we see were not in fact due to WIMPs, but could likely be due to neutrons. Okay. So once we've done that, we can quantify the results. So we have to conclude that we haven't seen anything. Okay. I submit to you that it's useful. It's nicer to see something, but it's also useful to not see something, right? Some theorists like Lawrence over breakfast on a Saturday morning might cook up some crazy theory. And if his theory is right, he might tell me, you know, you should see 37 events in 6 months if you do such and such experiment. And I come to him and I say, well, I don't see any events, okay? He's got to conclude that his theory is wrong. I don't mean to pick on Lawrence, but he's just here. Okay. So we can quantify that by making a graph of what we call WIMP nucleon cross-section. You could just take that to mean the probability that a WIMP would scatter from a nucleus, okay, versus the mass of the WIMP. Okay. I may not have mentioned this, but we don't know necessarily what the mass of the WIMP is, so we have to take that as a free parameter in the experiment. So the way to read this graph then is that if the mass of a WIMP was 50 GeV, or about 50 times the mass of a proton, okay, then if its cross-section were larger than whatever this is, 2 times 10 to the minus 41 square centimeters, then I should have seen it in my experiment. Okay. So any probability above, let's say, this blue line should have shown up in the experiment that I ran in 1999. Okay. So we call these curves exclusion limits. Okay, everything above the curve has been excluded. Okay, and so you'll notice in this graph several curves. Okay, which exclude the region of parameter space above them. Okay, you may also have noticed this region in the middle. Okay, the shaded green region. Okay, this is the result of an experiment that was run by some Italian competitors of ours. And they say that not only did they find a lower limit on the WIMP cross-section, but they find an upper limit. In other words, they're saying, we think we actually have seen something. Okay. Most of the community seems to think they're wrong. Okay. And you can see that the curve that we produced from our experiment cuts off most of this parameter space. Okay. Let me tell you a little bit about this experiment. It's been in the news. They published in the New York Times, okay, the preferred journal. They use a very different technique. They basically live with the haystack, okay, and they try to work around it in a different way. It's a very elegant method, but it's also difficult, okay. The basic idea is that they have a very large apparatus, about 100 kilograms. Am I running out of time? Okay. Okay, we should probably move to the video in a minute or so. So let me cut to the chase. Then the basic idea of this other approach is to take advantage of the fact that the Earth is moving around the Sun, and this would affect the rate at which you would expect to see these WIMPs. Okay. This is not unlike the Doppler calibration that Martin mentioned earlier. The basic idea is that in June, the detectors are moving slightly faster relative to the WIMP background than they are in December, just by virtue of the fact that the Earth and the laboratory are moving around the Sun. And so while the DOM experiment can't distinguish between most of the WIMP signal in the background, what they can do is look for an annual variation in the size of the signal. And they actually see such a variation. What's plotted here is the average value of the signal as a function of time, okay, with the mean value subtracted off. And this is over a period of 4 years, and you can see the rate rise and fall and rise and fall. Okay, so that looks pretty convincing. Okay, but we're doing experiments here, so it's important to do cross-checks to look at the same type of signal using different methods to see if you really believe what's coming out of a single experiment. And the bottom line is that is that if you try to simultaneously accommodate what we see in the experiment that I work on CDMS, cryogenic dark matter search, then you can't simultaneously accommodate both experiments. Okay, the detection in DAMA says that the WIMP should interact at a certain probability. Okay, and if we take that probability and interpret it in our data, it says we should see something at a much higher rate than we actually observe. Okay, so what we can do statistically is the best simultaneous fit. And you can see that this red curve, which is the best simultaneous fit to the two experiments, is in fact not a very good fit. Okay, we can't make the amplitude of this red curve large enough to accommodate DAMA's blue crosses, while at the same time keeping what we expect to see in CDMS small enough to be consistent with the zero that we measure. Okay. So we live in interesting times, and we don't know what the final chapter is going to be. Okay. What we're doing in CDMS is actually building a second generation experiment. And our Hawaii colleagues will appreciate this. Some of my colleagues get to go to Hawaii and get to work on mountaintops. What we actually do is take our experiment and we're sticking it in an iron mine 2,000 feet underground in an iron mine in northern Minnesota. Okay. What we're going to do now is show you a video taken by a couple of my students. We're going to take you for a ride. Okay, we're going to take you along to see the phase two experiment of the cryogenic dark matter search, which we're about halfway through building in an iron mine in northern Minnesota. Okay. There may be time for a question or two while we're switching over to the video. Yes?
What's the
anticipated mass?
Anticipated mass
of?
A WIMP.
Of a WIMP, somewhere, you know, anywhere from, say, 50 times to 1,000 times the mass of a proton. Okay. Yes?
These are cold dark matter.
Yeah. Okay. The question was, are these hot or cold dark matter? The two different. Maybe we should come back to that. Well, let me finish answering the question. Martin talked earlier about the idea that, you know, one of the things we don't understand yet is how we got from the smooth 300,000-year-old universe to the clumpy universe we see today. One of the clues that we get as to the type of dark matter we're looking for is whether this dark matter is massless relativistic particles or heavy slow-moving particles. The two different types of dark matter would greatly influence the rate at which gravity can allow the universe to become clumpy. Okay. So the kind that we're looking for is cold. So I should hit the space bar now. We don't have sound. It's going to be much more interesting with sound if we can do it.
Yeah. Dark matter search. We are in northern Minnesota. It's about 7 in the morning, Central Time. And we are on our way to work. We are doing an experiment which requires us to have good shielding from cosmic rays. So we are headed to the Sudan Underground Lab. That's an abandoned iron mine currently run by the state of Minnesota as a state park.
I'm going to pause this just for a second because you missed the first few sentences. The person who's talking here, his name is Don Driscoll. He's one of the graduate students in my experiment, and we asked him to do a movie of himself so that he could take you along down into the mine. Okay, so wrong computer.
Once we get there, we've gotta wait for the hoist to take us down. It's about a 2 or 3 minute ride straight down.
Notice the great north woods in the background.
It's a little. It's on a little bit of an angle, but we'll be going down into the mine. We'll be roughly half a mile below the surface.
Today is Friday. Most of the people who work construction shifts tend to spend 4 10-hour days with Friday off. But a lot of the people that you'll see going down are either construction workers or a couple of us from CDMS. They just loaded up the bottom shaft, so they're bringing down the bottom cage. So they're bringing this one down for me.
This is the same cage that the miners used to ride.
Light check, please stop.
Well, so are you standing under the drip too?
I don't know, I didn't bother to clean my jacket for less.
It's a dirty job and someone's got
it. It's a badge of honor, right?
That's right.
It's going to rattle and bang a bit.
This is actually a very small number of people. It's
probably is a slow day.
Yeah.
Seven and two. Signal for the 27-4, which is where we're going to go.
This buzzing that takes place is the handshake between the people in the cage and the operator in a hoist. It takes about 2 minutes to get down there. We're not going to subject you to the whole line. Like, only for tourists. We're hardcore.
No more getting in the field for a while.
Watch out for bats.
Small size. It all came down this hole, huh?
Yep.
Thank you.
Here we are.
Last one.
Final four.
You're up.
That's right.
So this is the rest of the little train car that they run the mine tours on.
Wow.
You may be able to hear some squeaking noises. There's a bat. Quite a large population of bats here in the mine. I'm sure there'll be someone flying along. Well, there was one. Headed now right towards the sort of CDMS mechanical area. This here are is where all the pumps are and the controls for the cryogenic area. The wall you see behind there is the wall to the clean room, so our detectors need to be kept in a very clean environment. We're doing a low background experiment, so things like skin cells have things like potassium in them, carbon-14, things of that nature. So it's not something that you want to get on the detectors because that will give you a background that could perhaps mimic a signal. Over here on the left, this heads to the other half of the Sudan experimental areas. The Minos Hall is down that way.
Don is showing you is the area of the experimental hall where we're building CDMS. And again, the idea for being 2,000 feet underground is that the limiting background in the earlier experiment was we're due to these neutrons.
Okay.
And the basic idea is that these neutrons are produced by cosmic ray muons that interact in the rock. Okay, if you stick out your hand here at the surface, you get about one muon going through your hand every second. Okay. These muons can interact in the rock, even in a surface laboratory, and smack into nuclei and liberate neutrons. Okay, these neutrons then wander into the apparatus and produce these background events. By going 2,000 feet underground, we now have introduced an additional 2,000 feet of shielding material, and the muon flux is reduced by about a factor of about 100,000. Okay? So this greatly reduces the flux of neutrons that the experiment is subject to, allowing us to push to lower backgrounds and therefore have better sensitivity for these WIMP recoils.
And it's amazing
it's really amazing what they're able to fit down that mine shaft, because the mine shaft...
It's about the size of a football field.
Down in,
yep. And there's actually two halls down there presently.
The only way to get anything in or out of the mine. So
this is the main hall. This is the original hall.
Heavy moving equipment.
There's another experiment in a new hall that was built.
All had to come down.
And that experiment isn't looking for dark matter. What it's doing is looking. It's trying to study the properties of the elementary particle called the neutrino. And the reason that it's underground is because it's also a rare event type of experiment. It needs to be shielded from sources of background.
One of the Fermilab techs. We're right now in sort of a
So we're now in the clean room of the experiment. Again, because I showed you that dust is radioactive, we have to try to keep the entire apparatus in a clean area. So when we go to work, we put on Tyvek suits. And so what you're looking at now is the outer part of the cryostat where we mount these detectors.
Combination polyethylene shields us from neutrons, and lead shield, which shields us from electrons.
So what Don was describing there was the kind of shielding material that we need to use to protect the experiment, even at these depths. Again, part of a multi-layered defense. And if you look around, I mean, you see drill presses and milling machines and toolboxes. You could almost forget that you're 2,000 feet underground.
Here heads into the antechamber for the clean room. So
now we're inside the clean room where the experiment is housed.
The block here is neutrons from radioactivity.
And it's a little hard to synchronize here.
So you see
these blue doers here are the refrigerators that cool down the apparatus, which is largely covered here. And Don's going to take you up the ladder.
Take a look inside.
And you can look down. And it's basically a large empty thermos bottle that is sufficiently well insulated that it can hold liquid helium. And that's one of the ways in which we provide cooling for the detectors.
So in this particular setup that we have, and the blue viewer here is almost identical to this one.
What they're trying to do now is verify in one of the tests that we're doing, base temperature of the refrigerator. Don't come home till you figure it out. Okay. Lest you think we just send our students there, I spent the entire month of July at the mine. Okay. It's actually a fun place to work. I think we should probably stop the video now. I think we've just about seen enough of that. Okay. Should we switch back? Yeah. Should I wrap up?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay. He means yes, absolutely. Okay. Are we back? Okay. So I just wanted to end with a photograph of our collaboration. There's about 35 or 40 active members that have been working together on this experiment. And I just wanted to mention a little bit about some of the people. Up here on the left is a gentleman by the name of Bernard Sagillet who pioneered this approach for using these very cold detectors to look for dark matter. He gave me a job in the early 90s, which is why I get to work on this experiment. Another gentleman in this photograph, let's see, is Blas Cabrera. He is one of the pioneers of using these superconducting films to make particle detectors out of them. Let's see. Yeah, you can see Harry Nelson, a member of the faculty here at Santa Barbara. David Caldwell, a retired member of the faculty here. Anyway, we're a pretty large group, and we have a lot of fun. We collected for the first time as a group 2,000 feet underground at a collaboration meeting last March. Okay. And I think I'll end there. Sorry if it was a little choppy with the video. We didn't really have a chance to rehearse that. But, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that was great. The cinema verite was really wonderful.
Yeah.
We have time. The way it's going to work is we have time for questions now, 10 or minutes or so for questions, and then we'll move into the town meeting mode, where I believe David will facilitate that. So, questions for Dan? Maybe you could. You can.
These weekly interacting particles. Mm-hmm. What kind of interaction do they have? Is it one of those four kind of interaction, or it's the
right,
new
so
kind of force?
Right, so the question is, what type of interactions do these particles have, these WIMPs? Okay, certainly they have gravitational interactions due to their mass. Okay, but in terms of the other three forces that you're familiar with, electric, weak force, strong nuclear force, we don't believe that they necessarily have any of these types of forces. We believe that actually this would be a new particle, a new type of interaction. One of the candidates for the type of particle that it is called a supersymmetric particle. Okay, there we have this very successful standard model of particle physics, which can explain all of the known data. But there are aspects of this model which are very ad hoc, and theorists have come up with a number of extensions to this model. To make it more natural,
okay,
and these extensions predict new types of particles. And one of the interesting things is that without any knowledge of cosmology, the types of particles that you would predict that would come out of these supersymmetric models or other extensions to the standard model have just the right property to be WIMPs. Okay, if things were the other way around and you knew about supersymmetric models first, and you knew that supersymmetric particles exist, you might actually predict that there would be dark matter. Okay, particles with just the right properties to have survived the Big Bang.
Okay. Yes.
Did you use these supersymmetric models to predict the mass value? I mean, how did you come up with the mass value of 50 times a proton?
You could, in some sense, predict it from supersymmetry, okay? But we actually have a better way based on the survival probability from this early universe argument, okay? Talked about how, based on the interaction probability of a WIMP and an anti-WIMP, that as the universe expanded, they would miss each other and fail to annihilate, okay? The other part of the calculation is to estimate based on let's say the temperature of the early universe, at what rate would these particles be produced? Okay, so we said that, you know, Einstein told us that we can convert energy into mass. Okay, but Boltzmann told us that if you have a gas at a given temperature, right, then you can work out the probability that a given collision is going to have a certain amount of energy. Right, kT will be the typical energy in a thermal collision. Okay, so if these particles are very massive, okay, then the probability that they'll get produced in a given collision at a given temperature will be smaller. If they're very light, then there's a higher probability that they'll get produced. Okay, so based on the fact that we need some dark matter, not too much, not too little, we can also constrain the range of masses that are appropriate to consider. Okay.
Dan, one thing that I want to just add that people might not notice, that curve you presented for your where they rule things out, you saw a lot of black dots. Those black dots are models that theorists have made up for supersymmetry for the kind of signal you would predict. And you could see that Dan has already ruled out a lot of those models.
With my 40 collaborators. Yes.
I think you may have just answered this, but you said that the probability of WIMPs and anti-WIMPs interacting became low. Is that simply because of the density
That's
lacking
right.
as the universe expands?
That's absolutely right. As the universe becomes more rare, then WIMPs and anti-WIMPs just won't tend to pass each other in the night as frequently.
Okay. A second question. Can you tell us a little bit about how you achieve 10
millikelvin. Sure. So how do we get so cold? One way to make a liquid colder is to let it evaporate. Okay, and you can hurry that evaporation process by taking a pot of liquid and hooking it up to a vacuum pump. Okay, so you'll maximize the pressure difference between the vapor above the liquid and the vapor pressure in the liquid. So by accelerating the rate of evaporative cooling, you can make a liquid colder. If you do that with ordinary liquid helium, okay, then once you hit a temperature of about 1 degree, the vapor pressure of the helium will essentially go to zero. So even if you have a perfect vacuum above the surface of the liquid, you'll get no evaporative cooling because there's no pressure difference to drive the evaporation. Okay. By using a mixture of helium-3 and helium-4, you can arrange for I'm not sure how best to describe it. But you can arrange for a sort of a two-part system, let me say, where the two isotopes of liquid of helium will separate. Okay, once you reach a certain temperature, around a temperature of a Kelvin, okay, the helium-3 and the helium-4 in this mixture will separate. The helium-3, being the lighter isotope, will float to the top. The helium-4, being the heavier isotope, will sink to the bottom. Okay. But the helium-4 will have a solubility, if you will, of helium-3. Okay, helium-4, even at close to absolute zero, will have a solubility of about 6% of helium-3. Okay, so now ignore the helium-4 for the moment. It becomes a superfluid and is effectively inert. Okay, so now picture just what the helium-3 is doing. You have a layer of helium-3 that floats to the top, and you have a dilution of helium-3 in this inert helium-4 on the bottom. Okay, turn it upside down, it kind of looks like a liquid and a gas. Okay, when helium-3 moves from this rich phase to this dilute phase, there's a latent heat associated with moving from one phase to the other. Okay, and so it's as if helium-3 is evaporating from the concentrated phase and going into the dilute phase. Okay, and this, so what happens then is that the remaining helium-3 cools. Okay. And the separation occurs at temperatures below a Kelvin and will continue essentially on to absolute zero. Okay. Eventually you have some finite heat leaks which come into the system, but you can, using this type of arrangement, you can reach temperatures of a few millikelvin.
You boil it upside down.
We boil it upside down, that's right.
We have a question from Hawaii, I think.
Yes, Hawaii.
Hello, this is Kerry. I'm from Hawaii. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Kerry.
Great.
Am I looking at you? I don't know.
I'm trying to wrap it up there. That's a real technical question, but I would like to find more about what you're doing in Hawaii. And the second part of that is that it seems like you're doing research iron mine way down on the ground. Are those similar experiments being done in the space shuttle?
I'm sorry, the first part of your question was, what are we doing in Hawaii?
Yes, do you have any activities in Hawaii?
Unfortunately not, no. I just get to go to northern Minnesota. Yeah. And what was the second part of your question?
Okay. The second part is, I was wondering if you did similar types of experiments on the space shuttle. It seems like the clean environment and stuff that you're talking about requires a lot of equipment underground. Is there similar types of experiments being done as part of the space shuttle experiment?
Is probably very clean in terms of dust, which is one of the things that we battle. But in terms of cosmic rays, it's terrible. You're bombarded by a much higher rate of cosmic ray interactions. In fact, these detectors that we have, we don't even like to fly them on airplanes. Okay, even you know, going up into you know, 30,000 feet of less atmosphere of shielding allows many more cosmic rays to reach our detector and deposit radioactivity on them. So space is actually a very harsh environment for us. But I think the next guy is going to talk about space. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, whoever scheduled me before the astronaut. I really appreciate that. Okay.
Well, you get one really quick question. Okay.
Yeah. It is super symmetric.
Yeah.
It's super symmetric.
partner of a fermion or a boson?
Yeah, and so the, yeah, so the question is, what supersymmetric particle are we seeing? Well, supersymmetry hasn't actually been discovered, and what we like to say is that half of the supersymmetric particles have actually been discovered, the electron and the proton and all those. So, you know, we're halfway there. What we would be looking for would be the so-called superpartners, right? And the one that we're looking for is actually the lightest superpartner, all the heavier superpartners being unstable and decaying into the lightest superpartner, also known as the neutralino. Yeah, yeah. Fermion. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Okay, so thanks again. Man.
Okay.
So,